0818-715-815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. Sinead was finally laid to rest around this time yesterday, and it emerged overnight, and indeed was mentioned from early morning that her brother, Joseph, novelist Joseph O'Connor, read his poem Blackbird in Dunleary at the service yesterday. And I suspect, like many, many platforms, we've been inundated this morning with people asking about the poem and people printing and reprinting the poem. But Joseph read the poem on drive time here on Radio 1 on the 31st of March 2010. This is Joseph O'Connor reading his poem Blackbird in Dunleary.
Dunleary, when I'm walking with my sons through the laneways called the Metals by the train tracks. And he sings among the dandelions and bottle tops and stones, serenading purple ivy, weary tree trunks. And I have it in my head that I can recognise his song, pick him out, I mean distinct from all his flock mates. But my sons insist it's fiction. Heard one blackbird, heard them all. But there are times he whistles up a recollection. There's a blackbird in Dunleary, and I'm suddenly a kid, asking where from here to Sandy Cove my youngest sister hid. I'm 11 this Easter, my job to mind her, Good Friday on the pier, and I suddenly can't find her. The sky like a bruise by the lighthouse wall. We were playing hide and seek. Is she lost? Did she fall? There's a blackbird in Dunleary, and the terror's like a wave breaking hard on a hull, and the people's faces grave as Yeats on a banknote, stern as the mansions of Killiney in the distance, as the pier's granite stanchions, and Hoth is a dead child slumped in Dublin Bay, and my heart is a drum, and the breaker's gull grey. The bats. It starts raining. The people's park and my tears of cold shame and the dog's bitter bark. There's a blackbird in Dunleary and I pray to him then, for God isn't here, in a sobbed amen. And she waves from the bandstand, her hair in damp strings, and the blackbird arises with a clatter of wings from the shrubs by the tea house, where old ladies dream of sailors and Kingstown and Teddy's ice cream. And we don't say a word, but cling in the mizzle, and the whistle of the bird getting lost in the drizzle. Mercy weaves her nest in the dead, wet leaves. There are stranger things in heaven than a blackbird believes.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And Joe at rt.ie and 51551 is our text number. Yesterday, you would have heard, well, the whole programme took off with a discussion about Deepest Breath, the documentary on Netflix at the moment. It's primarily about a young man from Dublin, Stephen Keenan, who unfortunately, tragically died when he was a rescue diver, safety diver in a free diving episode in July 2017. And that got us into talking about extreme sports and risks and adventurers and people talking about life or living and people stretching themselves to the limits. And we've come across a man called Mike O'Shea. Mike, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
Good. How would I describe you? Adventurer? Transport manager.
Carry man.
Okay. Now, how your life? Like, if we start talking about your life, we go all continents. But how would you describe yourself? You don't want to be described as a stuntman, because I know you do lots of work in movies.
I suppose a lot of the work I do is really the safety end of stuff as well. I suppose I do a lot of training for like rescue teams and stuff like that. I spent a lot of the years training the Irish Coast Guard and doing rescue training and stuff like that. And then also doing, you know, difficult acts and stuff like, so when they built the Aviva Stadium, I designed a system to enable the roof to be put on that. So yeah, it's a very mixed bag of stuff that I do. So I do, and in the film industry, it's a very mixed bag as well. Everything, I've done everything from stunts to aerial coordination to marine coordination. So I suppose I'm kind of a jack of all trades, master of none, you know.
And, well, I'll come back to the question later on, does anything phase you? But, for example, you're involved in Mission Impossible 7 and Mission Impossible 8. Well, Mission Impossible 7 is currently wowing everyone in the cinemas. What was your work there, Mike?
So the work on that was, I had worked on 6 initially for the whole helicopter stunt scene at the top of a cliff. So when they decided to do 7, Tom Cruise had this thing that he wanted to do. It was a big stunt from when he was a young fella. It was basically to drive off a ramp off the top of a cliff and then go into a base jump. So that's what we started working on. They came to me with the concept of it, and basically kind of went from there. We went to Norway. We spent a couple of days flying around Norway trying to find a suitable place. So we found the perfect cliff, which was about 4,000 foot tall, in this like amazing curry bowl. And then it was really a case of taking the stunt, the next stage of developing the ramp and practicing the stunt to make sure it was going to work, you know.
And people have seen it because it's on YouTube a lot. It's an incredible stunt. So did you, how did you build a ramp in the middle of nowhere and off the side of a cliff?
Well, I suppose it kind of started, it was actually during COVID. I was sitting in Dingle here for about 2 months. Kind of working away myself and working with the team that work with me, like the likes of Shane McCauley and Keane O'Driscoll and people like that. So we kind of worked up a plan for us, and we had come up with the best concept and the best angles and stuff to get this so that he could launch off at the correct angle for getting the flight. And then we built one in the UK, about 110 metres long, which again obviously features quite heavily on YouTube places. And that was a practice run where we had Tom was on the safety wire, so he basically drove the motorbike down the ramp and then flew off. And then so that was a test of concept to make sure it worked. And then we discovered that worked, and then we took that to Norway. And then we built the ramp in Norway, which was 205 metres long and 17 and a half metres high on top of like a 4,000 foot cliff. Like, so that was it was a fairly logistical nightmare to try and get all the bits and pieces there, you know, but yeah, it worked.
And what were you in charge of in that build, Mike?
So basically, yeah, so I did the worked in the initial design and stuff. Myself and Shane McCauley did most of the design work on it. And then I supervised the builds, put the team together for the build in the UK, and then the same for Norway. Because like it's obviously a very specialist thing. So we had equipment from the UK, we had equipment from Germany, the Netherlands, Holland, that we brought basically all the way up to Norway to build the ramp, you know.
And did anyone do the stunt before Tom Cruise did it himself?
No. He does all his own stunts. I mean, the practice runs in the UK, he did those. And then for the one in Norway, I mean, the weather when we were there was absolutely terrible. I mean, we had snowstorms, we had ice, we used to have to salt the ramp in the morning. And as it transpired during the period of time we were there, we only got one actual day of weather that was suitable, where it wasn't snowing or raining or doing something. You know, we got one day of good weather. And he actually did the jump 7 times in one day, which is absolutely, I mean, to do that jump once would be a big deal for most people, you know.
Seven times
back to back in one day was just mental, like, you know.
And given that we were talking a lot about safety yesterday, at any stage, who had the call? Was it you, Mike, who could say, no, we're not doing
well, the ramp end of things is me, so I would have looked after the ramp. But I mean, at the end of the day, it's down to, I mean, Tom is doing the jump, so you know, if it's Tom or a stunt performer doing something, I mean, the call at the end of the day is them, if they're happy with the conditions to go for it. And I mean, he's a consummate professional as well. So, I mean, I've never met anyone with a work ethic like him or, you know, a really good technical knowledge of everything. So he was very, very involved in all aspects of the design of the build and stuff like that. Came and inspected it, looked at it and understood how it all works so that he was happy with it. And then, you know, once he's happy with the ramp, the next part was really to sort out his, you know, make sure he's base jumping. But I mean, his ability for base jumping while we were building the ramp, I mean, he was flying over the top of the ramp in a helicopter, doing the same speed we do in the motorbike, and then just jumping off the front of the ramp as we were working on it, so building it. So, I mean, he was training for that stunt right up until the last minute. Like, you know, he had every angle covered. But, again, it's a huge stunt. You just need one mistake, and you're in big trouble, you know. So,
that's what I'm thinking,
he's a very brave man, but, like, to be honest with you, he does, at the same time, he does the preparation for it. I mean, I've never seen anybody put in the sort of work of preparation to, you know, to have his skills honed so well that, like, when he did that, you know, there was nothing left to chance. He had done everything he could possibly do to make sure the stunt came off right. But it's still, you've got to look at the, you know, you're driving like a you know, 50, 60 kilometers down a ramp that's up to 17 meters in the air. It's only like 8 foot wide. That ramp is only 8 foot wide when he's driving down it. So it's quite narrow. And that in itself would be fairly entertaining besides trying to actually jump off it and then parachute, you know. So, yeah, it was an amazing piece of skill.
And if something was to go wrong in your risk assessment, Mike, what was most likely to go wrong? The ramp or the motorbike in the air or the jump or the landing?
I mean, to be honest, there's so many elements in it. You know, everything from like going down the ramp, you could have got a puncture and then come off the ramp, or it could have, you know, it could have been anything. Or he could have got tangled up in the motorbike when he separated off the. So, I mean, like, you know, he, like, really at the end of the day, I mean, it was like everything was in position and everything was down to him. He had to get everything right. He had to get the right speed to jump off the ramp. He had to make sure that when he went off with the bike that he actually separated at the correct time from it, you know. And then, like, he had a specialist team in there. Wade Eastwood is the main stunt guy that works with Tom, and he kind of works on the concept and trains with Tom. So, like, he had done all his jumping, he'd done all his stuff, and they had perfected how to separate from the motorbike. So it was amazing. Like, I mean, it was amazing. It was an amazing concept to come up with. I mean, people have done similar stuff to it, but, I mean, at that sort of scale and at that sort of height, there's nothing like it that I know of, you know.
But at that type of scale and that type of height, we're talking about Mission Impossible, the one in the cinemas at the moment, Mission Impossible 7, and this incredible, it's on YouTube there, this incredible jump that Tom Cruise does himself. I suspect if that has been done before, Mike, it hasn't been a stunt man or a stunt woman on it. I suspect it's probably a dummy on it. It's so dangerous.
No, well, yeah, it all depends on the sort of height. I mean, there is a number of, I've seen one or two guys who've done it off sand dunes and stuff like that at very low levels, which is obviously high risk as well, but certainly nothing at that sort of scale. And certainly, like, I mean, you have to remember at the end of the day that Tom is an actor and he's not a full-time person. Yeah, he still has to act and he still has to produce and he still has to do all the bits he does. So, I mean, he's just an absolute machine. Like, I mean, his ability to, you know, encompass all the work he does in the day. He's still got to do his lines and he's still got to do all these bits and pieces to go with it. So, I mean, his mental capacity for absorbing information and then for retaining it and then putting it back out is just, it's exceptional, you know.
Wow. And as the fella said, what was he really like?
I actually enjoy him. I actually have good fun with him, to be honest with you. I mean, we had a good laugh. I mean, certainly on the... After he did the jumps the next day, he came up to thank everybody for it. Like, put all the crew together and thanked everybody. Which, you know, that's one thing I would say about him as an actor, which I haven't seen with a lot of actors, is he actually does involve the crew. He thanks the crew, and if people aren't directly involved, he'll bring them to see it. But when he finished, he said, When I landed the last time, the farmer said to me, why did you keep doing it? And he just laughed at the farmer and he just said, basically, have you seen the guy who built this? And then just, you know, hit me on the shoulder and walked off laughing, you know. So he is a character. You can have a bit of fun with him. You know,
okay. Isn't he an honorary Irishman? Ireland, I think it's a good 10 years ago, the Taoiseach at the time, Eamon Gilmore, brought him to the Department of Foreign Affairs in Stephen's Green and conferred him. I think it was an idea that was in its infancy. They conferred him with as an honorary Irishman, given his Irish roots. But there you are. You mentioned other actors you were. Oh, by the way, have you been? Is work on Mission Impossible 8 finished? The next one?
No, there's still work to be done on that. But obviously, all the whole film industry has stopped up now with the strike going on.
Of course, yeah.
So everything is on hold at the minute. You know, good question. No?
And you were involved
but
in...
There's still some work to do on 8. They still got quite a bit of stuff to shoot on 8, yeah.
Oh, is there? Yeah, okay. You were involved in Gladiator 2 in Morocco, which I presume is on ice as well at the minute, is it?
Yeah, everything's on ice, yeah. Everything all over the world is on ice, yeah. So, yeah.
And Gladiator 2 with Paul Mescal, that's the Irish interest. Gladiator 2, had that started filming, Mike?
Yeah, we did some filming in Morocco, and then they went on to Malta. So they were based out of Malta for up to quite recently, you know. So yeah, that's all wrapped up. Everything is wrapped up at this stage. Yeah.
So is that when you say wrapped up, do you mean on ice or do you mean finished?
No, as in everything's on ice at the
moment. Yeah, because of the strike.
When the writers come back and the actors come back, yeah. So I think everything pretty much all over the world has stopped at this stage. No?
By the way, did you go and see Mission Impossible 7 in the cinema in Dingle?
You might laugh. Well, there's no cinema left in Dingle, unfortunately.
Oh, the last time I was there, there was a beautiful little cinema.
It was great little cinema. It just closed down quite recently. You might laugh. I haven't seen it. I've been on the road for like 9 months. I was in Jordan last year working on Dune, and then I went straight on to Mission this year working up at Svalbard, and then I got home for 2 days and went straight to Morocco. So I've actually spent the last 4 weeks at home here trying to catch up with myself with paperwork and sorting out the house and things like that. So
brilliant.
Hopefully at the weekend I'll get to go and see it, you know.
And were you talking to Paul Mescal out in Morocco?
I did meet him, yeah. Very nice gentleman. In his GAA shorts, so yeah, you couldn't miss him, you know.
But apparently he's been in the gym and he's lean and mean and muscled and...
I mean, he's a very fit man, like, for sure. Like, I mean, yeah, definitely. I've spent a little time with him, but I mean, certainly from meeting him and looking at him, yeah, he's a very, very fit man, like, you know.
Okay. Indiana Jones you worked on?
I did. I had two legs of that, one up in Glasgow and another one in Jordan, yeah. So that was pretty mad, you know. Morocco. I'm so many movies tonight, I'm getting confused with everything. Yeah, we were in Morocco for that one. That was amazing, because it was great to be in that whole world of, you know, something that you've watched since you were a child and grown up with it and looking at it, and then, you know, getting to meet the cast and getting to see that whole world and how the production is put together. You know, it's pretty wild, you know.
And did you meet Harrison and Phoebe and?
They were on set every day, like, you know. But yeah, he's still a very active man for his age. Like,
wow, yeah.
He's well able to act and do his part, you know.
Did you see Indiana Jones in the cinema? Don't tell
I
me.
Did,
no.
I did.
Oh, great! Oh, thank God.
When
you're in the cinema, Mike, looking at movies that you organise these incredible feats in, do you nudge if you're with somebody? Do you nudge them to say, "I did that. I did that. I built that."
To be honest with you, I usually don't go with. I usually either go on my own, or I might bring my daughter Molly with me. I would like to be nice, but I do make Molly sit till the end. I still get a little bit of a kick, I must say.
When your name comes up,
I still get a kick of seeing my name up on the screen. So
brilliant.
I always sit till the very end. So at Indiana Jones, myself and Molly were the only two left in the cinema, sitting there watching the thing. You know, so it was interesting. You know,
I'm talking about and the name that comes up at the end is Mike O'Shea from Kerry's Home at the minute. In between, we were talking yesterday about. Do you understand, Mike, like with Tom Cruise, he doesn't have to do that stunt that he did, that incredible stunt that you organised and built and with the crew. Do you understand what drives him?
I mean, that's, you know, he's got that adventure streak in him. You know, he's got that kind of, you know, risk element in his nature, you know. And I think if you've got that in your nature, it's very hard to keep it down. And I mean, he's created what I would say he's created the ultimate for himself, in the sense that he can do, you know, all of these things that he wants to try and do. He has created an environment for himself over the last 35, 40 years to actually be able to do every single thing he wants to do. So every sort of stunt he wants to do or every experience he wants to do, he can now play that out through Mission Impossible. So I think hats off to him, because he's created the perfect environment for himself to get to do all the things he wants to do. So I think it's amazing, you know.
And what about you? Do you have that sense? You must.
I do. I get a kick out of stuff. I mean, I've obviously climbed a lot. I've done a lot of rock climbing over the years when I was younger in the Alps and such as that. And I've been to the Himalayas climbing and climbed all over the world, really. And then done quite a bit of polar stuff. So, I mean, I like the challenge. I like the, you know, I like the kind of planning of the trips. I like the, you know, there's a whole lot more to a trip than just, you know, the trip itself. I mean, there's the whole planning element, which I get a real buzz out of the planning element of it. And then there's obviously going to the preparation and stuff that goes into that, the training, getting yourself fit for it, and then heading off and doing the trip. So the trip actually ends up being quite a small part, but then coming home to telling friends the stories and what happened and how it happened and stuff like that. So there's a lot of different elements to an adventure. Like, I mean, look, some you succeed on, some you fail on, and it all depends on how far you want to push it, you know, how remote you want to go with stuff, you know.
Because there's a beautiful scene, and there's many beautiful scenes in Deepest Breath, where Peter Keenan, father of Stephen Keenan, who is the subject of the documentary on Netflix, he had this beautiful memory of himself And Stephen, I got the sense Stephen was about 10 or 12 or whatever, when the two of them would go swimming, and the two of them would go swimming in the sea at dawn, in the 5 o'clock in the morning, snorkeling. And he just described that so beautifully. And you could see almost from what Peter was saying about Stephen, where Stephen got that sense of adventure. When did you start adventuring, Mike?
Oh, I was very young. I mean, I was only about 14, 13 or 14. I started, I was before for U Club, and we went to Captain Lee Outdoor Education Centre, and we got rock. We did canoeing that weekend, which I thought was okay, but it didn't really affect me. But I went rock climbing, and that just sparked the whole thing. So I kind of ended up joining Kerrymount Rescue Team then for years, and just got into the whole climbing and stuff. And I was headed off to the Alps for the first time when I was about 17. That was the good old days with no telephones and no nothing. And I was in the Himalayas by the time I was 21. So, you know, I suppose I was very lucky in that I met a lot of the right people and were just in the right place for a long time. So that, you know, that was interesting. But going back to your point about sense of adventure and stuff like that, something you're just reminding us there. I was at a conference, it was like an adventure weekend, and I was speaking, there's a guy from County Clare called Fergal Smith. I think you may have heard of him. He's a very, very famous surfer. The Aileen Wave, just off the cliffs of Moher there. And it was very interesting, the two of us, like, we hadn't met before, knew of each other, but hadn't met. And he did his presentation and I did my presentation. And it was so funny afterwards, like, for two guys who were into the whole adventure world, both having a conversation where I could not, in my wildest dreams, conceive what motivated him to do what he does. And he was exactly the same with me. I mean, what he did, what he does with those waves and the time they spend under the water when the waves break, that frightens the life out of me. And then he looks at myself and it frightens the life out of him. So it's actually, it's very interesting in that we all have, I suppose, a risk aversion to certain things, and then certain things draw. So I suppose it's different for everyone. It depends on what you're exposed to, I suppose, when you're younger, you know.
Okay, stay with us, Mike, please. I'm talking to Mike O'Shea. Adventurer is the word, logistics, organiser, traveller. You've travelled in the footsteps of your fellow Kerryman, the great, great Tom Crean. I know you've done that. You've climbed K2, Greenland, and you've worked on more. You've worked on James Bond's last. Okay, we'll talk about that after the break. Joe at RT.ie, 51551 is the text number, and the WhatsApp number is 087-184-3709. 087-184-3709.
Talk to Joe on 0818-715-815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And Joe at RT, I'm talking to Mike O'Shea, and it's a continuation in many ways of a number of angles that were raised on the programme yesterday about risk-taking, about adventuring, about what sets people off to do incredibly difficult and at times incredibly dangerous things. Mike mentioned working with Tom Cruise, and he mentioned that Tom Cruise does his own stunts. And Larry Taylor is on the line. Larry, 51551 is the text number. Larry, like, what more evidence do you need from Mike that Tom Cruise does his own stunts?
Well, it sounds very credible what Mike is saying, but it just interests me that in the stuntman world, Tom Cruise's name doesn't seem to be awarded or nominated for a stuntman award himself in the way that, say, Michelle Yeoh is for doing Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, that kind of thing, or Jackie Chan, or even Buster Keaton, you know, many years ago. I'm just wondering, is the criteria for winning or being nominated for say a Taurus Stuntman Award, is that something that's ineligible for or has not been recognised yet?
To be honest with you, I couldn't tell you. I presume you need to be part of a stuntman's guild or something like that. So I couldn't really offer it, but that would be the only explanation I would have, is that he's not part of a stuntman guild. I mean, I've worked with him on three productions, and in all of them, he certainly has done all his own stunts. I mean, I've certainly been asked that question a lot of times, where people say, "Does he really do it?" Like, you know. And I've even been asked that by stuntmen. Like, but I mean, I've physically stood there and watched the man doing them, so I can 100% confirm he does them. But as to awards and stuff like that, I don't know. You know.
But is he not nominated, Larry, for Best Actor? Larry.
Yeah, I mean, but that's not, I mean, possibly, yeah, he is certainly for some work, and he's won, I think, Best Actor as well. But I suppose my question is more about the recognition for his, because he's spent so much time and effort in promoting the stunt, for a lot of movies. I'm just kind of surprised that it hasn't ever been picked up and recognised by any kind of, you know, the stunt men. Mm. So, but Guild, if there is such, I didn't know there was. I'm not in the business, so I don't know.
Okay.
If there is there a stuntman guild that he needs to be a member of. Or is it something that's kind of unrecognized? I mean, I know it's not something that the Oscars even give an award for. They don't give best.
They do not know, okay.
Best stunt man, best stunt woman, which is kind of probably an oversight. But and I guess because the back of probably a lot of people's minds is like, how could a man who's presumably uninsurable for a lot of these stunts, and is also has so much resting on his capacity to continue to work on the movie and the amount of money and the risk and the production company that needs to support him to do this is either signing a lot of waivers, this left, right and centre to continue to do it, and considering his age as well. Like, I mean, it's amazing that that's so much risk is associated.
61, yeah. But,
yeah, with so much money at stake and so many other jobs at stake to keep production rolling along. That's one. I mean, stuntmen ultimately. I mean, I think, from what I know anyway, little about it, they do get hurt. They get hurt a lot, and they recuperate, and some of them don't. Sometimes they go back to being unable to work, and that's the end of their stunt career. But it's doing those stunts repeatedly, personally, by himself over years and years. I know he broke his leg or his ankle on one stunt.
That's right, on a roof somewhere, yeah.
It's shocking parts to it to me. I'm just wondering.
Now you've raised a number of, like a sequential question. Mike would be: Do you know if stunt men and the stunt women, brilliant stunt women, stunt men and stunt women, the stunt guild, would they resent Tom Cruise doing his own stunts?
I don't think so, really. I mean, he's working in a different environment. I mean, the stunt world is. I mean, they're all very, very professional what they do. I've worked with, a huge amount of stunt people, and I think the level of work they put in and the level of training they put in is just phenomenal. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously he gets to do a lot of very nice stunts some people would like to do themselves, you know. But I mean, I've never met any resentment. I mean,
okay.
He has a stunt team that work with him on the preparation stuff. So, I mean, there is certainly a group of stunt, like, I mean, while Tom, you know, he's not a lone crusader in that thing. I mean, there's like Wade Eastwood, who's the main stunt guy that works with him on everything. So, you know, that's all about the planning and the preparation. I mean, obviously, he decides he wants to execute the stunt, you know. So I think that's just a choice he's made. But I think he's created that environment for himself over 30 years. I don't know of any other actors that are left to do stunts at that sort of level. Because of what's been raised there is the ability.
And then the other question Larry raised was insurance. How would he get insurance?
I don't think I think insurance for a lot of those stunts is pretty much. I think insurance is pretty much null and void for a lot of those. You know, that sort of level. You know.
Well, you couldn't add it to your VHI travel insurance. Sure, you couldn't. It's incredibly. What was your point? No, your point, but your description.
Yeah.
Your description, Larry, was better than mine. The value of Tom Cruise in terms of.
That's just it. I mean, I assume like you were saying there. There's no way you'd actually get a formal sanction from the production company, even if it's his own, I think, to do it. Maybe he signs off his own.
Well, he must.
He must do. But I just think it's extraordinary. The risk versus reward on this is, it just doesn't add up in my head. It's like for someone who's, except for the fact that there is so much marketing and so much promotion goes into the fact that he does his own stunts.
Yeah.
It seems to be the selling point of the marketing.
Okay.
I mean, even Google just motorbike stunt today. Tom Cruise is wall to wall every result, there's an awful lot of work that goes in to circulation on social media. I mean, I work in social media and I can see a huge amount, like wall to wall coverage on every platform, on TikTok, on YouTube, just of him preparing for a stunt and doing a stunt more so than anything else about the movie.
But so, do you believe Mike, Larry?
I would no doubt to suggest that Mike is not telling the truth. I mean, I believe what he's saying.
But
he was there, I wasn't there.
He was.
I'm just
And there's so many people there. If Tom Cruise was slipping off the bike before it took off and someone else was slipping on, that would get out, especially as you say, it's a unique selling point to the movies, most of this stage, that I do my own incredible stunts.
Yeah, it's just amazing.
It is part of the USP. I mean, it's a big part of the USP for the production, but also the whole behind the scenes for a lot of movies is almost as big as the movies, because a lot of people nowadays, you know, want to see how the movie's done, how it's made, what are the elements. So, you know, there's a whole other world there as well, in the sense that, you know, people want to see how is the movie made, how is the stunts. I mean, like, all the video evidence is there of Tom doing all his stunts and playing the part of them. So, you know, I think it's a foregone conclusion. He definitely does his own stunts. You know?
Or is it, Larry, that the world we now live in is so commodified, is so overwhelmed, smothered by corporate this and insurance that and indemnity this, that we find it hard to believe that Tom Cruise actually does this?
Well, maybe part of it is to do with his persona, his personality and his other, you know, activities outside of filmmaking and his association with Scientology, and maybe the credibility of his statements is lessened somehow, I think, because he, some of what he's saying, if you see some of the stuff that's out there on his association with Scientology and with it just seems like he may be living in Tom Cruise's little world, you know, a little bit removed from reality. And so I suppose by extension, maybe there's some doubt about whether his credibility as claims of stuntmen goes hand in hand with that. But again, if you have first-hand evidence of people there, and a lot of people there, then you can't argue with this. It just makes the story even more like, wow, you know.
Do you remember that time, Larry, he was in Ireland?
Yeah.
I had the full details on the screen, but they're gone now. And he was in Ireland, and everywhere he went, he was being followed, including this campus. There was hundreds of people outside waiting to see him. He's a big...
Yeah, that was huge.
And he got, a certificate of Irishness, Larry. But Scientology wasn't raised at all that week, was it?
I suppose it's kind of irrelevant, isn't it? I mean, his own personal religious beliefs.
Well, as you know, the Scientologists have a major presence in Dublin between their incredible headquarters in Merrion Square, which is, they have billboards outside every day. If you suffer from procrastination or you want a personality test, come into us. They have an incredible premises out there in West Dublin near Talla. So they have a big, but he didn't go near them when he was here. So I presume he just separates everything.
Yeah, maybe it's just one facet of his life, and it's not relevant to his film work. Like you say, he doesn't make a big song and dance about it when he's talking about his film. Certainly, it's mentioned at all. It's just very private.
Never
thing,
mentioned
presumably.
It. Yeah.
Yeah, I presume it's just a private thing. You know, that's up to him. Fair use to him if he wants to do that.
So you do, but you are a believer now, Larry.
I am always going to have a bit of scepticism in the back of my head.
Mike, you're in Kerry. Is there any holy water near you? Is there a copy of Peg you can lay your hand on and swear on Peg?
I've more chance of swearing on Peg than I have in the Bible, that's for sure.
Well, will you swear on Peg in front of me now that Tom Cruise does his own stunts?
100%, yeah. Okay. Stood there and witnessed itself, yeah.
Okay, as Peg is my witness.
I wouldn't hold a lot of people in awe in my life, you know, for their work ethic and stuff, but I mean, certainly that man, I definitely do, you know, and the work he puts in. So, yeah, 100%.
All right, well, that's good enough for me. You know, I'll stick my scepticism in my back pocket for now.
Well done.
Thanks for that.
Okay, sure. Larry, no, you're not a doubting Thomas. You were doubting Larry, but no longer. Thanks to Pagan. Thanks to Pagan, Mike O'Shea. Mike, thanks, Larry. Yesterday on the programme, Mike, somebody made... she got a lot of criticism for Paul, I think her name was. That was her name at the start of the programme. And she said no one with dependents should be allowed to... Well, she described it as reckless, insane. She was talking about free diving, and she also talked about mountain climbing. Is there a line? Is there a red line?
I think I suppose yes and no. I mean, the thing is, look, I mean, like, we all are individuals. We all have our own personality. We all have our own personality traits. I think if somebody, you know, is into a sport, whether it be, you know, soccer, there's no issue with a guy going out to play soccer. There's no issue with a guy going to watch soccer. I think the thing is the same. It's like, you know, if you are as a person are that way inclined, whether it's cycling, whether it's football, mm-hmm. whether it's rugby, whether it's mountain climbing, I mean, that is your thing, you know. And I mean, I think if you as a person give that up, you're losing part of your own value and your own person. And by doing that, you're not going to live your life to, you know, your fullest. Mm-hmm. You're not going to be good enough for the people around you. I think you need to do what you want to do and hopefully get support from the people around you. Because I understand the whole thing with dependence, but I mean, if you are somebody that's going to be very sad and very pissed off for the rest of your life because you're not doing what you need to do, you know, and I think that, you know, for somebody to be whole in themselves, they need to be able to, you know, live their life, whether, you know, it's going to a rugby match, whether it's playing rugby, whether it's climbing mountains or whether it's free diving. I think, you know, that's got to be something that people have to be supported in, you know. I mean, that makes the person, you know. And mm-hmm. if you're not going to support the person, you know, you're not going to end up with a real person, you know.
Mike, have you ever turned back? I see on your list K2, Greenland, Siberia, the footsteps of Tom Green. So that's the South Pole. I suspect you've done the North Pole as well. But have you ever torn back? Have you ever said no?
Oh, I mean, I have certainly torn back. I mean, look, I mean, you know, you mentioned K2 there. I was part of a team that climbed that. I mean, I certainly turned back on that mountain early on. The team did succeed. It was very different. That was 1993. It was a very different time of climbing in the sense that, you know, the climbers climbed the mountain. It wasn't with Sherpas. You use porters and stuff to get to a base camp, but then climbers climbed the mountain, whereas nowadays it's very different. It's slightly different. It's commercialised. People still have to climb the mountain, but there's a lot more support in place. And certainly twice I've had to turn back. I've been on a North Pole expedition, and twice we've turned back on that. And, you know, once was an injury, and the second time was basically we just didn't have the money for the logistics because one of the teams fell out of the expedition. So, I mean, look, there's always, and climbing in the Alps and climbing in the Himalayas and stuff, there certainly is times where, you know, you have to make a personal decision for yourself. You know, is the risk too high for you? And that, everyone has a different risk perception, you know. I mean, it's a big conversation, I think, within the adventure world is people's own personal risk perception. Like, you know, it's like someone, like a rally driver. I mean, everyone can drive a car. But yeah. I mean, how many people could drive it at sort of speeds around? You know, so it's everything's about your own personal risk perception and how you perceive the risk and where you're comfortable, you know.
And Manuel De Lucia. Manuel, good afternoon.
Afternoon, Joe.
How are you? You want to be described as an adventurer, which is what I describe Mike as. Go ahead.
Yeah, in the sense that my adventures were kind of, how would you say, community bound. In other words, I trained as a diver and I have been diving and spearfishing and free diving since 1955.
Okay.
So that'll give you an idea of how old I am. I was 15 when I started. And I've been in Kilkee all that time. I've lived here all my life. And my diving was kind of a skill that I used within the community to look for lost souls and save people from drowning, which I have done many, many times, and recovered quite a lot of lost souls. And in 82, I set up a unit here, the first in Ireland, called the Kilkee Marine Rescue Recovery Service. And we had over 30 good members in it that were all highly trained. And we have recovered, I think, something in the region of 70 lost souls and rescued from around 700 people from drowning. Wow. That was all totally voluntary, and not a lot of people knew that. But my adventures would have been free diving to 150 feet with some of my spearfishing buddies, and training to go to competitions. We represented Ireland in Chile in 1970, and in the Europeans in the Isle of Man in 1972, and, you know, but most of my adventures have been community-based adventures, and you know, a lot of close shaves within that period of time, looking for bodies in caves and in very rough seas and stuff like that, you know. But well capable of doing it, but never took a serious risk. Like, I think people that go climb K2 and climb Mount Everest are taking serious risks. But then they get their kicks out of that. I got my kicks from recovering lost souls.
Okay, but you mentioned that you did free diving. And yes. Was that dangerous?
Of course it's dangerous. I mean, any time you hold your breath and go down to 140, 50 feet of water, well, you don't have any air to get. You have to hold your breath and come straight back up to the surface. And as somebody said to me the other day when I did another interview with somebody else, what about the bends? Well, you don't get the bends when you're free diving. You have air, breathing in air at 14.7 pounds per square inch on the surface, and you hold that until you come back up again. And when you come up, you still have only 14.7. Whereas if you take a breath out of a diving tank at 100 feet and hold it till you come up to the surface, you're going to blow up. Your lungs will explode because of the increase in the pressure and volume.
Yeah.
So there you are. You know?
And would you describe yourself as an adventurer?
I would, yes. Okay. I would. Okay. Absolutely.
And when did you start? Mike was 14 in the youth club, and that fateful weekend, the kayaking and the rock climbing, which he loved. Kayaking, he wasn't mad about the rock. When did it start for you?
When I was 15.
15, okay.
After my father dying, my mother bought me a mask and snorkel and a pair of fins. And I took off into the sea, because I live right beside the Atlantic Ocean here in Kilkee. Mm-hmm. And crystal clear waters and loads of fish around. I used to go out spearfishing and studying them around town, you know. And I moved on from there. Then I took up the scuba diving. I went to Dublin and did a course with the Irish Tobacco Club in Dublin. And then I went to England and did a commercial course. And, you know, I've progressed ever since. And I used to teach children here at the Polycoles, you know, the famous Polycoles.
They're the
eighth natural wonder of the world, I call them. And I used to teach children there, now free of charge. I wouldn't charge them. I don't charge children.
Okay.
And I must have taught about 200 or 300 kids how to snorkel, and just had great time in the pools, looking at all the fishes, and I'd explain everything to them. And they got a good grounding there, and a lot of some of them have gone on to do diving and spearfishing and stuff like that. You know.
And when did you move to Kilkee?
When I was 6 months old, back in 1941. Do you remember that time, Joe?
I read about it in school. The emergency, the Second World War, and Torfid, the Phoenix Park.
That's right.
And rations, and the Glimmer Man, and all
that. That's right.
So you were 15 when you started. Okay, do the math, as the fella said. You're a brilliant age at the minute, and by the sounds of it, will be for many, many, many years to come.
Hopefully.
You're in your 80s, I reckon, now.
82,
don't you?
Okay. 82.
And the name, Manuel de Lucia, I'm pronouncing it wrong, I know.
Lucia.
Yeah. Where did that come from?
Italy. My parents, now, funnily enough, my parents were all born in Ireland, and his brothers and sisters. And my mother's brothers and sisters, my mother's name was DeVito.
You'd know that
name.
Danny.
From that famous adventurer, stuntman, that giant of a man called Danny.
and he related to Danny DeVito?
Yes, my cousin. He's my mother's cousin.
Fantastic.
He's been to see us. Yeah.
But your parents today, it's all about film stars today. Why did your parents come to Ireland?
They were in Ireland. They were born here.
Oh, your grandparents.
My grandparents came from Italy. They were kind of tradesmen. They worked on churches like marble and terrazza mosaic and all that.
Yeah.
And they came to Scotland, and then to Scotland, to Belfast. And they had all their family in Belfast. And then my father and mother moved down to Kilkee in 1941, in the spring of 1941. I was born in November 1940, and they moved down here and took over a cafe belonging to an uncle of my mother's. And we've been here ever since.
And we've
made our mark.
And did they run it as a cafe?
They did, yeah.
As fish and chip or whatever, okay.
Yes.
And what's your next adventure on your list?
children in my life. I think have a chat with the Undertaker.
But what?
Make sure he has. I'll tell you a funny story. A friend of mine came here one day. I was after coming out of hospital, having had a heart attack, and I was in the shower. And my wife opened the door, and he was standing there with a bowler hat and a measuring tape. And he comes in, my wife comes in and says, somebody out in the hall to see you. So I came out, dressed myself up, and there he was. And he says, the Undertaker sent me up take your measurements.
Good luck. Well, and what is it, I've asked Mike the same question and people yesterday, what is it that drives you to... extremes is probably the wrong word, but to test yourself.
Well, you know, you always kind of try to improve. I wouldn't say it's testing. I would say it's improving, you know, improving your capabilities and trying different things when you're dealing with the sea and different seas. You know, I mean, I used to lie in bed at night and I'd be holding my breath. Now, I held my breath once. In a tub of water pub down in Bantry for a bit for 4 minutes and 45 seconds, which was, that was back in 1971 or 72 when I was working on the jetty there. But, you know,
please
that
do
was
not,
a good achievement.
Please,
then.
Please, yeah. Nobody listening, try this at home. It's so dangerous.
No, don't try this at home.
Okay, Manuel.
It's highly dangerous.
Okay, Manuel, do you know Mike O'Shea? You're only across the estuary from each other.
No, but I'll wave to him now because I can see Kerry from where I am. Okay. I can see the McGillicuddy Reefs and Mount Brandon. Hello, Mike. How are you?
Hello, Pat. How are you doing?
Doing good. Doing good.
Okay. Great to hear from you, Manuel. And many, many more years of adventuring. Mike, what's next on your list? Well, a job, I presume, with this strike ends.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see now what happens on the work front. But yeah, I'm kind of finished what I'm doing at the minute. So I'm just waiting for some new work. I've got some new projects because I'm waiting for it to be announced. So that's coming. And then on the adventure front of things, I'm doing this project called the Poles of Inaccessibility, which is basically trying to cross every continent through what's called the Pole of Inaccessibility, which is the very midpoint of it. Mm-hmm. So I've done three of those, and I have three left to go as well. So that's my kind of main project at the minute, working on that.
Okay, and so you're generally your day to day challenges in Kerry at the minute are very different to your day to day challenges up to quite recently and in the future.
Well, yeah, this is it. Sorting out the house and working in the garden. That's
yeah.
the
okay. Okay.
When you're away so much, things get out of hand, you know.
These are joy as well. Okay, well, kind regards, Mike, to you. And you mentioned Molly earlier on, I presume it's your daughter. And kind regards to you and your family. And thanks indeed. Incredible, incredible story. Mike O'Shea and Manuel de Lucia.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
By the way, we will shortly put Joe O'Connor's powerful reading of his own poem. He did it here in 2010, but it's the poem he read yesterday at Sinead's funeral, Blackbird in the Lily. We will put it up on Twitter in the next few minutes. It would be at RTE Liveline or at Joe Liveline, and people can listen to it then. And it has such power, and Joe's voice in itself has power regardless of what he's reading. But obviously there's, and looking at the reaction from people reacting to the Irish Times, publishing people now retweeting the words of the poem, but the voice of Joseph in reciting his own poem, we'll have it up in a few minutes. Okay, let's go. I will forever refer to it as Tato Park. I think, I don't know why they rebranded it, but it's now called Emerald Park. It's in North County Dublin, Dublin stroke Mead, Ashbourne. But there's, to say that we've been inundated is not an overstatement. With people who have discovered they have an issue with Tato stroke Emerald Park. Marie, good afternoon.
Oh, hi, Joe. This is Marie here. Thanks for taking my call. Joe, I just want to talk about my own personal family experience there at Emerald Park on Sunday.
Okay.
Yeah, there's five of us in the family. We went up to the entrance to the counter and we got our wristbands. And then I asked for the queue assist for my daughter. I had a letter of her diagnosis of CP, cerebral palsy.
Okay.
And the guy, yeah, and I was told at that stage then that you'd have to have a medical assessment.
A medical assessment, are you lying?
A medical assessment by a member of their staff. So she was there, she was in her wheelchair buggy, and I explained to them, look, she have to have the pass because she wouldn't be able to walk in that. And then I was told to, we were standing around, we didn't know what to do or anything else at that stage. And then we were kind of moved on into the entrance, into the atrium part, and that we were told that two members of their staff would come and assess our daughter. And we were there for a few minutes. It was a very public place, Joe. You know, there's people everywhere around and there's no bit of privacy whatsoever. And we were standing there for a few minutes. And then eventually two members of their staff came over and they proceeded to give our daughter this medical assessment, she's additional needs and it was kind of, you know, it was a bit embarrassing. It wasn't degrading and embarrassing. It wasn't a nice experience to have to go through this. And they asked us our booking reference. They asked us our diagnosis. And they also asked me my name. So I'm not too sure what they wanted that information for. In hindsight, I probably should have asked them, but I didn't ask them that. And they assessed our daughter and was she able to sit up and, you know, push her hands forward and this sort of thing. But like, they did give her the fast pass, they did give her the queue assist, which was fine, but it was just this whole experience of having to do a medical assessment for our daughter, you know, who has got additional needs. It was stated quite...
Well, Marie, has this happened before in Emerald Park or Tata Park, or has it happened before in other theme parks?
We were there last year. We go there every year. We travel up from Kerry, and no, this certainly didn't happen last year.
Didn't happen last year. Okay. So why the change? Nicola Riley. Nicola, good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon, Joe. Thanks for taking my call.
Okay, and thanks for making the call. Tell us, what's your experience?
So again, like Marie, family day out. There were 10 of us: myself, my husband, my three children, my sister, my mother, and her children. Travelled up. I had pre-booked online, which I do every year, physically.
Okay, Nicola, your line is so fuzzy. We'll try and improve it. I'll come back to you in a sec. James Doran, James.
Hi, Joe. How are you keeping?
What's your experience?
My experience is quite similar. We would have arrived at the park pre-booking and also asked about the queuing system. My young lad has mild CP, so he can walk, but he wears a plastic AFO to help him with his walking.
Okay.
So he was 6 years of age. We actually have a large buggy for him because he gets tired quite easily, but he can walk. So they told us at the time they don't give out anything in terms of a Q pass for his condition. Mm-hmm. And they would recommend that he does not go on the rides. So we thought it was just around a pass, that they didn't want to give a pass and that we were only looking to skip the queue, which wasn't the case. So we just took it on the chin, weren't happy about it, and we went to the very first ride. And we queued up for 45 minutes. And when we got to the top of the queue, we were told that he could not go on the ride. Because he was wearing his plastic AFO, which is a splint, in essence. So we didn't see the signage around the ride, but it does state that no splints are allowed. Okay. Now, I've been in Orlando last year and Disney World and Universal. We're only just back from Port Ventura in Spain. All these parks have no issue and also facilitate not just kids with CP but other disabilities, and there's no issue. It actually is a great system out of Emerald Park, and I don't know why they find it so difficult to discriminate against a lot of kids with this condition, because at the end of the day, when you're trying to tell a six-year-old boy that he can't go on a ride, it has a long-lasting effect, because this kid, I'm trying to encourage him and his mother, you can do whatever you want. And for someone to say, you can't do it, it's kind of, we're trying to fill him with confidence, because he's only six. He hasn't experienced what he's potentially going to be facing growing up, and having, I suppose, the negative feedback from the only team park in Ireland, really. And they're saying,
and James, has it changed? Has their policies changed in Emerald Park, / Tater Park?
No. And I was even checking up on it afterwards. If you go onto actually the website and you can see all the rides and attractions and all that, there's 31 rides. My son can only go on four of them because he wears an AFO. Now, he's the correct height to go on everything, but he's restricted all because he wears a plastic AFO on his foot.
But my point was he restricted before?
In what way? As in he's able to go on everything.
Yeah, but that's what I mean.
Yeah.
So he's why? Unfortunately, we can't get a spokesperson for Emerald Park / Tater Park. Which is a pity, because they've sent in a number of statements, and they're very hard first of all, the first statement says the policy has not changed at all, and people are telling me it has. We got on the rides before.
Yeah, what would happen there in that case is my son would have to take off his AFO, and there would be no issue. And my son needs the AFO to help him walking around the park. Now, my son has no issue getting on any ride. He can walk on it. He can do all this. We've done it before. He enjoys them. My son is trying to play a sport in terms of football. And in fairness, the local football club, Pike Rovers, are brilliant with him to facilitate him. He goes up there. He's running around. It's a contact sport. No issue. Same with the Athletics Club. He trains every week. He enjoys it. Mm. I don't know how dangerous for my child it is when he can clearly get on the ride himself and get off himself.
Okay. As I say, it's a great pity, because when Ray, who's the Mr. Tato and Mr. Perry, and Ray unfortunately has died in the last year or so. But when Ray was starting Tato Park, he was forever on RTE. I heard him on the business programme. I heard him on with Marion Finucane talking about his dream and the zoo and the whole thing. And now when something arises, which is, they won't supply us with a spokesperson. Now, they do. Okay, this is the breakdown of what we can work out from their no change policy. They've a category for guests with a pre-existing injury or health condition, and another one for guests with a cast, splint, air boot or brace. There are 31 rides and attractions in Emerald Park, and if you belong in either of these categories, you can only access about 13% of them. If you break down, 23 rides are fast-moving attractions. If you have a pre-existing injury, a health condition, or a cast, splint, etc., you're not allowed on any of these 23 rides, i.e. 0 out of 23 rides are open to you. And of the 9 attractions, including the petting farm and the steam train express, you can access only 4 of those. So that's 45%. And by the way, if you're pregnant, you can only access 2 attractions. So that's under 7% of the park, but I presume they'd keep saying safety, but what we want to know is why has it changed, and this is what callers want to know. Okay, back after this break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Nicola is back. Nicola on a better line, I think. Nicola, what is your experience in Tato Park, Emerald Park?
Hi, Joe. Sorry about that. Yeah, I'm back. So mine would be very similar to Marie's in that I travelled up to Tato Park with, there was 10 of us, my family, my children, my sister and her children. I had pre-booked the tickets online, so obviously I had booked an additional needs ticket for my son. We went to the check-in. There was no issues there. We got checked in. And then I realised I hadn't been given the queue assist pass, so I asked the lady at check-in.
The which pass?
The queue assist pass, which is the fast pass.
Okay. And you got that before?
So I had got that, yes. Last year we got that for him, no problem, once I presented a letter from his doctor detailing his diagnosis.
Okay.
So the lady then at check-in told me, oh, I'm very sorry, cerebral palsy is the one disability that does not get a fast pass. So I looked at her and I kind of went, sorry, you know, half a smile. I actually thought she was joking with me, I'll be honest with you. And she reiterated it. So I said, look, we've never had this issue before. Can you go double check? And in fairness to the girl, she went and she double checked. And she came back and she said, no, I'm very sorry. Cerebral palsy is a pre-existing health condition, which means they don't get it. So at this point, I just asked for a manager. And a manager came out. And again, she reiterated the same, said, look, cerebral palsy is a pre-existing health condition. We don't know if your child can brace, if your child can hold. So I looked at her and I said, look at my son. My son is 11, nearly 12. He's mobile. He was standing next to us. She could see that he wasn't. So again, no, she said, sorry. And I explained, I said, you do realise cerebral palsy is levelled, like it's an umbrella term. And I said, there's level one to five, level one being the lowest, level five being the severest. My son being a level one. And again, I was told no. So like Marie, I was told I would have to have a medical inspection on my son, which I agreed to. We waited. Two first aiders came out. At this point, my son was obviously getting frustrated and agitated. He also has an intellectual disability, so he didn't understand why his siblings were gone off into the park. And he was standing in the middle of the atrium with me while everyone was watching. In fairness, the two first aiders came over and they looked at my son and he said, you know, why are we here? And I explained. And they basically looked and said, I don't have to touch your son. Just by looking at your son, I can see his movements. There's absolutely no problem. And we did get his fast pass. But I mean, it took 50 minutes. You know, there was no judgment call by anyone looking at a child standing in front of you, walking, climbing. My son was over rattling door handles because he was getting frustrated. You know, it was just, it was disheartening to see my child. Basically, my mind was being discriminated against because a letter that my doctor had given me said he had cerebral palsy.
But that was
what triggered.
See, Emerald Park are telling us, the opening line is, our policy has not changed. Has it changed?
No, we were there last year. Yeah, it definitely has. Like, no one ever mentioned anything last year about his letter stating he had cerebral palsy. And that was the key word this year.
And is there a reason why they've changed it, even though they say they haven't changed it?
I have absolutely no idea. I was told it was all to do with policies and procedures.
Yeah, but their opening line says, it does not just say our policy has not changed. They said, with the Irish emphasis, our policy has not changed at all.
Yeah, no, something has definitely changed.
Okay, Linda, stay there, Nicola. Linda Duffy, you've been going to Tato / Emerald Park for 17 years. Has the policy changed?
I've been going for 17 years with my daughter who had cerebral palsy. And she's wheelchair bound. Yes, it must have changed because we've been members of Tato Park for years and we've always been offered the queue assist pass until a few weeks ago.
And what were you offered or not offered a few weeks ago?
I just asked the young lady at the desk, I said, can we get the queue assist pass? She was there with her friends and she said, I have to ask my manager. And I said, no problem. And she came back out and she said, manager wants to know her condition. I went, okay. I said, I have a primary medical cert here if she wants to see it or anything. And she went in to talk to her manager and the manager said no. And I said, well, can I speak to the manager? Mm-hmm. And she said, yes. Yeah. So the manager came out and I said, look, I have Cuiva's primary medical cert here if you want to have a look at her condition. And she said, no, I'm sorry. She doesn't qualify for a pass. And so I said, can I just ask why would she not qualify for a pass, even though she's qualified for years? And she said that it would be quite dangerous if she went on rides one after the other. And I said, oh, okay. Mm-hmm. I said, in what way? And she said, well, it just could be do damage to her. And I said, well, what do you know about my daughter's condition? How are you going to tell me that it's dangerous? I said, are you telling me that I'm putting my daughter in danger by going to Tater Park? And she said, no, I'm not telling you that. And I said, could I buy a Q-Pass? And she said, yes. Which I thought was okay. Ridiculous.
Okay. Yeah. Bridget Moore, has the policy changed?
To be honest with you, Joe, I'm not sure what's going on. Like, we have been going there. I've always called Tater Park our happy place. And we've been going there for years as a family. And, you know, my daughter, she's 21 and she has mild cerebral palsy. And she doesn't get on an awful lot of rides, but she had the opportunity if she wanted to. And my argument is, you know, we as carers and parents are not going to put our children in danger and put them on rides that we don't feel they're safe on. I didn't go to Emerald Park. I had planned on going. Mm-hmm. So I contacted them because I'd heard rumours this was happening.
Okay.
And I was basically told that because my daughter has cerebral palsy, she wouldn't avail of a fast pass. To me, this just doesn't make any sense. You know, every child deserves a childhood. Every face deserves a smile. This is shocking.
But the point is that people, children with CP have got in before.
Yeah, I've gone there every year and so there's never been an issue.
Okay, well, that's what I'd love to know. Has there been an issue? Has there been a problem? Aisling McSweeney, Aisling, what's your situation?
Yeah, very similar to the rest of them. We went, there definitely must have been a policy change because in 2021, when it was Tater Park, we brought my daughter with her brother and we went with other families. And we went in, we had no problem getting queue assist pass. Katie was in her walker, we had the wheelchair. If she fatigued, Katie went on the Viking Voyage, she went on the Cuchulain, she's that type of child. She's a thrill seeker, just like her brother. And we had the best day. So last year then, we booked the same people again. We booked and we went to pay and I asked for a queue assist pass for my daughter and they said, sorry, she doesn't qualify. And I said, okay. What do you mean? And, you know, I said, she's in a walker, she has a wheelchair, she tires. And they said, no, sorry. So eventually we called, you know, the manager. Okay. She did get the queue assist pass.
We've a whole, like, a whole stack of calls making the same point, but I'd read again. I don't know if Ray Coyle's family still owned Tater Park, but Ray was such a brilliant communicator, God rest him. And I'd love a spokesperson more. But anyway, I'm trying to read this paragraph from the Emerald Park statement. If someone with cerebral palsy has or is using a splint or braces, our EMT assessment would ascertain that they are able to use the rides and are therefore granted a queue access pass. With regard to your query about pre-existing health conditions, this is again lifted from our ride manufacturer's operation and maintenance manual. Okay. I suspect we're going to be coming back to that, looking at the volume. Joe Tierney, go back to where we started about adventuring and why people take risks. You're doing a PhD in this whole area on motivations, is it?
On motivations, yeah, I'm looking at reimagining aging through outdoor adventure. So rather than looking at people as being old and not being able, look at them in the context of what they're able to do. And that's my research started 6.5 years ago in the area. It was a part-time PhD at the Technological University of Dublin. Yeah. And I'm a member of the lecturing team in the Technological University of the Shannon. In sports and recreation, and more specifically, inclusive sports and recreation.
What drives people, Joe?
What drives people is a connection with like-minded people and engagement with nature, with the natural environment. There are other benefits that, you know, it's different. You have to consider heterogeneity of all the people. They're very different, and they're not a homogenous group. And what drives them is the impact that it has on their resilience, their health, and in particular, in the context of their own self-esteem, their own self-efficacy and self-determination in relation to things like autonomy, competence and relatedness. There are lots of connections with people, lots of opportunity to engage at a level they want to engage at. And they all recognise the risks associated with the activity, but they still continue to participate. Even people that had quite serious and chronic illnesses continue to participate in their activity. So I've had people that I interviewed that are getting over heart surgery and people that were getting through cancer and dealing with cancer and other issues. But their outdoor adventure was something that they held on to.
OK, but did this issue come up, which is the issue raised by Paula yesterday about Deepest Breath, and Stephen Keenan was a safety diver. He died, but the diver didn't die, so to speak. Did they Correct. Talk about dangers to people who go with them?
Are you asking the question in the context of the people that I interviewed?
Yeah.
All of them recognise the risks associated with their sea swimming. Some of them are distance swimmers, and some of them are self-named dippers. In other words, they just get into the water winter and summer, and they just dip. But they're all very much aware of the dangers that are associated with sea swimming. As the same applies to scuba divers and the hill walkers that I interviewed. Their attitude is an extremely positive one, and they suggest that they just manage the risks. The attitude to one person in relation to COVID suggested that at the time of cocooning, he's probably 76 or 77 now. I interviewed him 2 years ago, and he suggested that, look, the likelihood of me getting COVID on a mountain is highly unlikely, but the likelihood of me getting it walking through the town within a 2 kilometre radius or a 5 kilometre radius at the time of the restriction. So the idea is that they manage the risks themselves. They recognise the risks and they manage them. You're talking about
I'm way over time again, unfortunately.
Okay.
That's just really appreciate this conversation. We'll continue, but why people do dangerous things. Thanks indeed, Joe Tierney. Annette Egan produced. Ciara King is next.
0818 715 815 stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.